Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Nathaniel Hurd, an independent consultant to the United Nations who assesses the international body's mission in U.S.-occupied Iraq in the aftermath of the bombing of their Baghdad headquarters. William Turner, former FBI agent, who analyzes how the upcoming 2004 presidential election may affect U.S.-Cuba relations. And Winona Hodder, director of Public Citizen's Critical Mass Energy Project, who examines the massive August 14th power blackout and the role utility deregulation played in weakening the electrical grid. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The New York Observer reports that a high-powered group of lawyers and retired federal judges has blasted the Bush administration's treatment of Jose Padilla, an alleged al-Qaeda operative who has been classified as an enemy combatant. Although he has been in military custody for over a year, Padilla has never been charged with a crime or given access to a lawyer. The U.S. citizen was arrested for allegedly trying to organize a plot to set off a radioactive dirty bomb. Retired federal judge Harold Tyler, who served as deputy attorney general for Republican President Gerald Ford, has put together a legal brief that critiques the treatment of Padilla. Tyler told The Observer, "We have something called habeas corpus, which guarantees that a person who is held incommunicado has to be produced in court. The people in government seem to have forgotten that." The brief was filed on July 30th and calls the Bush administration handling of the Padilla case one of the greatest threats to the rule of law and to the liberty our Constitution enshrines. Last year, a federal court ruled that Padilla had a right to a lawyer and a hearing in court. The Bush administration appealed, saying it has evidence showing Padilla had contacted top-level al-Qaeda leaders. The appeal could be heard in federal court in New York in September. The Center for Public Integrity reports that commissioners and top staff at the Federal Communications Commission took nearly $2.8 million in travel and entertainment gifts from media and telecommunication industries since the mid-1990s. The FCC, led by Chairman Michael Powell, has pushed for massive media deregulation that would place more power into the hands of fewer broadcast companies like Fox and Viacom. The June 2nd ruling to permit even greater media consolidation has provoked a public uproar. Even the Republican-led House of Representatives has voted to overrule the FCC. Over the past 6 years, FCC officials went to hundreds of industry conventions that were held in hotspots like Las Vegas, New Orleans, New York, and London. The National Association of Broadcasters, which represents local TV and radio stations, was the biggest sponsor, which paid over $190,000 to have 206 FCC officials come to its events. FCC Chairman Michael Powell took 44 industry-sponsored trips at a cost of nearly $85,000. Robert Pepper, head of the FCC's Office of Plans and Policy, who took 104 industry trips at a cost of nearly $150,000, defends the industry-sponsored trips. He explained, "We need to understand what the industry is doing, and the industry needs to understand what we are doing. We need to get outside the beltway in order to do that." Critics counter that the FCC has gotten too cozy with media executives. As Andrew Schwartzman of the Media Access Project observed, the only thing getting left out of this whole process is the public. In late July, human rights activists praised an Egyptian appeals court for releasing 11 gay men who had earlier been convicted of debauchery, an Egyptian law that bans consensual gay sex. According to Human Rights Watch, the men were among 16 gays charged in February 2003 after the police tapped a phone in an apartment in Greater Cairo, where men were suspected of meeting for sexual relations. Police made the arrests after they taped a series of phone calls. In other cases, undercover police officers have tried to solicit gay men over the internet. A 23-year-old man was arrested by the Vice Squad after he responded to another man in a chat room. Egypt's intense anti-gay crackdown started on May 11, 2001, when the police raided the Queen Boat, a floating gay disco on the Nile River. 52 men were arrested and put on trial for their sexual orientation. As Michael Heflin of Amnesty International's Outfront program observed, the raid marked the beginning of a 2-year public campaign of harassment, intimidation, and detention of those perceived to be gay. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.
The powerful bomb which destroyed United Nations headquarters in Baghdad August 19th that killed 20, including the UN's top diplomat in Iraq, Sergio de Mello, has caused many to reflect on the world body's role in the war-torn nation now under American-British occupation. The deteriorating security situation inside Iraq has prompted many UN and aid workers with non-governmental organizations to head home. With more than a dozen attacks carried out against coalition troops daily by a shadowy guerrilla force, an increasing number of military analysts and politicians are calling for additional American soldiers to be sent to Iraq. But the Bush administration has thus far resisted pressure to deploy more than the 139,000 U.S. troops already stationed inside Iraq. In the days after the UN bombing, the White House seized on the tragic loss of life there to solicit support from a skeptical Security Council to send additional troops and aid to Iraq. However, nations such as France, Germany, India, and Pakistan are resisting pressure to place their troops under U.S. command, preferring instead to be part of a mission sanctioned by the UN. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Nathaniel Hurd, an independent consultant to the United Nations, who assesses the fallout from the UN bombing and the obstacles ahead for the U.S. in stabilizing Iraq and gaining international cooperation.
Clearly, there were a lot of warnings prior to the U.S.-led invasion and occupation that any parties, the UN or other, who were associated with the invasion and or occupation would potentially be targets. I think that as far as the UN was concerned, because the UN, at least in areas of humanitarian assistance, political transition, etc., aims toward impartiality and is there really to serve and to assist, that generally the UN has not been subject to this kind of attack in the past because of its activities and because of its reputation. But clearly that was not the case. I think you were dealing with a very different situation, really in almost an unprecedented situation in which the UN was following in on the heels of an unprovoked invasion that most of the world opposed.
The identity of the individuals or organizations behind this bombing is not yet known, but what's your guess as to the motivation in targeting the United Nations? Was it to disrupt the U.S. occupation by way of targeting the U.N. and by extension all the international aid that was being funneled through the U.N., or was it more particularly directed at the U.N. and its role in Iraq over the past 12, 13 years?
You mentioned the 12-year engagement with Iraq. The U.N., again, was put in a rather awkward position. You obviously had the Gulf War and all of the damage that ensued from that and the resulting public health catastrophe. You had the continuation of Security Council economic sanctions, which gave rise to and then maintained a humanitarian disaster, a well-documented one. So certainly Iraqis, on the one hand, viewed the UN as there to serve and so forth. On the other hand, not really taking a firm stand in the face of sanctions consequences. But at the same time, with the exception of one shooting incident, the UN was not attacked during its 12 years in Iraq up until now. And again, this really in part has to do with the problem of coming in on the heels of an invasion and occupation and being perceived as somehow being complicit in that. But I think, you know, in this case, as you pointed out, we don't know exactly who did this, and so it's all a matter of speculation. But perception of the UN as helping an occupier may have been part of it. Another part of it may have been to send a message to countries who were considering sending troops to Iraq to assist in providing security, that perhaps they ought to think twice, that there are parties in Iraq who are willing to target anyone, including UN personnel. So I think there are any number of plausible explanations for the why, but again, it's all speculation at this point.
What can you tell us about what's happening at the UN now in terms of the United States trying to pass resolutions within the Security Council that might entice some countries like Germany and Russia and France back into a role, like a post-war role in Iraq?
Well, they're certainly trying to entice, but at the moment no one's biting. The U.S. basically wants a very odd kind of burden-sharing, a burden-sharing in which other countries contribute troops, but those troops will be under U.S. control, a burden-sharing arrangement whereby other countries provide money, but the U.S. controls the money. And this is totally unpalatable to almost all of the countries to whom the U.S. has put these kinds of requests, and the big ones in particular, you know, Pakistan, India, France, Germany, etc. It's a non-starter to say that troops would be under U.S. control, and it's also a non-starter, it seems, that the U.S. will be controlling donated funds. Another issue, though, has to do with the process on the ground, and what a lot of countries are insisting is that there be a shift away from occupation, effectively, to an international stabilization force in the interim before Iraqi security institutions are built, and that the political transition process be clarified as well.
Do you believe the Bush administration is going to budge in the near future under international pressure as well as the pressure of continuing guerrilla attacks as well as the deaths of increasing numbers of U.S. soldiers?
I'm not very optimistic because there are some indications that the administration actually has potentially a very high tolerance level for military fatalities. Last year there was an interesting article in The New Yorker in which a man in Washington, Nicholas Lehman, he was lunching with a senior administration official who spoke approvingly of a study that was done by an academic consortium that was looking at this question of military fatalities. And the conclusion of the study was that the civilian population here in the U.S. would be willing to tolerate up to 30,000 military fatalities, not just casualties, but fatalities, in a campaign to disarm Iraq. And the second major conclusion was that the primary issue was packaging the message, that if the mission was properly explained, then the population would have a very high tolerance for military fatalities. So there's that, and then, of course, you know, we remember the experience of the Johnson administration during Vietnam, where bodies, American soldiers, were coming home quite regularly, and yet the administration just dug its heels in, and it wasn't for quite some time before it decided to change course.
That was Nathaniel Hurd, an independent consultant to the United Nations. For more information and analysis on the U.S. occupation of Iraq, contact the Group Occupation Watch at area code 415-255-7296 or visit their website at www.occupationwatch.org. As potential candidates set their sights on the 2004 U.S. presidential election, U.S.-Cuba relations hang in the balance. Although during the past 3 years the Bush administration has maintained a tough anti-Castro stance, a group of Republican-elected leaders in South Florida have recently signed their name to a letter demanding harsh changes to current Cuba policy. 34 elected Cuban-Americans from the Miami area, the hotbed of anti-Castro sentiment, signed the letter, which asks for funds to increase the broadcast range of radio and TV Martí. It also asks for implementation of Title III of the Helms-Burton Act, which allows Cuban-Americans to sue in U.S. courts for property situated outside the U.S., to stop Cubans from being repatriated when picked up at sea, and to cease any further sale of food to Cuba by U.S. farmers. Although some who signed the letter said it should not be perceived as a threat, the document claims unfulfilled promises by President Bush may result in the loss of economic and political Cuban-American support. William Turner is a former FBI agent and author of 9 books, the most recent titled Rearview Mirror, Looking Back at the FBI, CIA, and Other Tales. He spoke with Between the Lines' Denise Manzari about how the upcoming 2004 presidential election may affect U.S.-Cuba relations.
George Bush is very much on the side of the Florida emigres who are so vitriolic about Castro, and Brothers to the Rescue, the head of that organization, was involved with the Contras in Nicaragua during that effort, and he has a long history of being involved in radical right-wing causes. Now, you have to understand that the three light aircraft, one of them did briefly enter Cuban airspace, but they had dropped pamphlets over Havana a week earlier. And they had been warned by Castro to stay out of Cuban airspace, so they actually violated the warning of Castro as to what would happen. So they were asking for it. By doing that, they probably had some idea that they would provoke an international incident. Brothers to the Rescue supposedly was rescuing boat people coming out of Cuba and bringing them to Florida. But actually, they were engaged in more than that. They were engaged in counter-revolutionary activities, such as dropping the pamphlets, trying to stir up a revolution inside of Cuba.
Eloy Gutierrez Minoyo was originally part of the July 26th movement, fighting side by side with Fidel Castro. He was later imprisoned and upon his release came to the U.S. He was a co-founder of Alpha 66, known for carrying out several violent counter-revolutionary actions. In 1993, Gutierrez Minoyo founded Cambio Cubano, which he claims promotes dialogue with Cuba. Now 68 years old, Gutierrez Minoyo has renounced his exile and has returned to Cuba, where he says he will work for peace and reconciliation. Former FBI agent William Turner offers his analysis.
He is one of the co-founders of Alpha 66, which was mostly composed of professional people like accountants and all who had exiled themselves from Cuba. Actually, Alpha 66 grew into one of the more enduring and violent of the exile action groups. Minoyo was involved in some of those raids on Cuban shores that Alpha 66 pulled off in the late 60s.
Given his history, his connection as a co-founder to Alpha 66 and founding Cambio Cubano in 93, knowing full well what his intentions are, yet he was allowed, I believe, knowingly to visit his family in Cuba, and there was plenty of people here, particularly in Miami, that would say Fidel Castro wouldn't allow somebody like that to visit. People are saying that all the time, and yet it seems that he was allowed into the country. Do you want to comment on that?
Well, Minoyo's already spent time in a Cuban jail years ago before
yes.
he was released and allowed to enter the United States through Puerto Rico. But I can't understand why Castro would allow him to come in if he's going to agitate. I think if he does engage in those kind of anti-state activities, that probably he will be deported or jailed.
Although the Bush administration claims there is no impending plan to invade Cuba, former FBI agent William Turner offers his prediction.
Castro and his high command actually believe that. They're absolutely convinced in their own mind that he is entertaining the idea of an invasion, preemptive strike, a regime change in Cuba.
And what is your opinion of that?
I'm sure it's on the table inside the White House as one of the projects that they hope to do. I don't think it would happen before the 2004 elections for political reasons, because there was a lot of momentum towards normalizing relationships with Cuba, or at least arriving at a modus vivendi.
Do you think it would prompt him to do something prior to the election to prove his promise to the Cuban-American community in South Florida?
Well, I'm sure he'd like to land on an aircraft carrier in Havana Harbor. If Bush gets in again, and that's very iffy at this point because he's plunging in the polls, if he gets in again, I predict that there will be an overthrow, a regime change in Cuba, and he'll simply find some weapons of mass destruction twist, as the British would say, sexy it up. As a pretext for going in there.
That was William Turner, former FBI agent and author of Rearview Mirror, Looking Back at the FBI, CIA, and Other Tales, published by Penn Marin Press. On the afternoon of August 14th, the lights went out across eight states in the Northeast, Midwest, and Eastern Canada. The massive power outage, which disrupted the lives of an estimated 50 million people, was triggered by faults on the grid believed to have started at an electric plant in Ohio. Since power was restored, representatives of utility companies and government officials have placed the blame on what they describe as an antiquated electric transmission grid system in desperate need of modernization. The Electric Power Research Institute, a group funded by the utility industry, has estimated that it will cost taxpayers $100 billion to upgrade the grid. But consumer groups point to deregulation as one of the primary sources of problems on the grid. They claim that a privatized, profit-driven system promotes high-volume energy trading that overloads transmission lines, provides disincentives to make necessary repairs, and hire adequate numbers of personnel to perform preventive maintenance. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Winona Hotter, director of Public Citizen's Critical Mass Energy Project, who examines deregulation's role in the degradation of the grid and pending energy legislation that she says will likely exacerbate the problem.
This type of blackout is exactly the kind of event that opponents of electric utility deregulation predicted would happen, because after deregulation, all of the emphasis, all of the incentives are for making short-term profit. It's also interesting that the area of the blackout coincides with the area that's been most deregulated and where the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has issued orders that also deregulates transmission by setting up these regional transmission operators that are very important for deregulated generation.
How can you trace deregulation as one of the root causes of the blackout that many millions of citizens experienced back on August 14th?
Well, I think it's a catalyst, and it appears that the link was First Energy, which is a company that has been formed as a result of deregulation. The Ohio-based energy conglomerate is receiving blame for the outage, and they really skimped on maintenance in a number of areas. Their nuclear power plant, Davis-Bessey, almost had acid eat a hole through the lid of the reactor. It's the worst event that we've seen since Three Mile Island. They tried to make improvements on one of their coal-fired plants and broke the Clean Air Act and have gotten in trouble for that. And so when you have a company like First Energy that's more concerned about their bottom line than about reliability, we see problems with maintenance and upkeep on transmission. And that appears to be what happened when their coal-fired plant, Eastlake, stopped running, and then they began to pull about 20% of the power from that plant out of Michigan to meet their needs. And this transfer overloaded several transmission lines, causing them to trip. And so, you know, we, rather than calling for building massive amounts of power lines, as we see many of the energy companies doing, we need to really look at what happened and how it relates to deregulation.
Winona Hotter, there are calls now for spending $100 billion to upgrade the grid, the mechanical and the electrical connections that keep the power flowing. How do you respond to the idea that it's really a matter of a technical fix here, rather than reforming and, as you've indicated, re-regulating the utilities as part of the solution?
Well, it's no surprise that the energy interests that have been promoting more market trading and more building of power lines so that they can do more trading are going to use this massive blackout as an excuse to call for building more power lines. But when consumer groups talk about investments in power lines, that is something very different than when Buffett or energy companies that want to invest in building new power lines talk about it. What we're talking about is looking at the current system, making upgrades where it's necessary, making sure that reliability is taken care of. What they're talking about is expanding electricity deregulation, having more of these long-distance trades, and building more power lines so that that is possible. For instance, they'd like to have access to power out of the Northwest where hydro makes it very cheap, which of course would raise energy prices in that region of the country and would make it possible for power to be brought eastward and for a lot of trading to occur and for these companies to make a lot of money. But this market trading generally raises the cost of energy. We've seen that the trading needs to take place about 6 or 7 times. That's paper type trades. And then when they actually move the energy, you lose from 20% to 35% of the energy, depending on how long a distance they're trying to move it. So maybe their market theory on this looks good on paper, but the laws of physics really work against the power industry and this kind of market trading. And this is really about corporations wanting to make a lot of money out of what is a monopoly business, and they intend to use this blackout as a way to do that. I think the connections to the energy bill haven't been made strongly enough, and there's a very contentious part of that legislation. In fact, it kept it from passing last year, and that is to federalize the power system, giving the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission power over states of eminent domain so they can condemn land and force localities to build transmission. And also, very importantly, there's been almost no examination of the provision in the energy bill that would make it possible to raise the rate of return on building new power lines. Right now, the rate of return is capped at right around 10%, and this federal legislation would change that so the rate of return could be as much as 25%. And then they want consumers to pick up the tab for building all of these new transmission lines. So I think that's very problematic, and there should be a lot more honesty in looking at this energy legislation.
That was Winona Hodder, director of Public Citizen's Critical Mass Energy Project. Contact Public Citizen by calling area code 202-546-4996 or visit their website at www.citizen.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests or would like a recording of today's program, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. You can also visit our website at www.btlonline.org. Our theme music was written and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Britta Brundage, Bill Cosentino, Denise Manzari, Anna Manzo, Harry Minot, Bob Nixon, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Sasha Summer-Cousineau.